The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're taking science out of the lab and into everyday life. A little later, I'll speak to researcher Bobby Duffy about a survey that explores some very common misconceptions about statistics in the UK. And I'll speak to Katie Gibbs of the new nonprofit Evidence for Democracy about their project trying to bring more science into public policy in Canada. But first, guest host Rochelle Saunders speaks to an author whose book makes the case for why everyone needs to know more about science. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders. Today I'm joined by Dennis Trumbull, a project scientist in the Circulatory Support Laboratory and an adjunct professor of biomedical engineering at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He is the holder of many patents for biomedical devices and has published numerous research articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals. Today, we're here to talk about his new book, The Way of Science: Finding Truth and Meaning in a Scientific Worldview. Welcome to the show, Dennis.
Thanks, Rochelle. Thanks for inviting me.
I just want to open with this quote from your book because I think it's really great. Most people love science the way they love their cars. They don't really know how it works, but they're happy to extol its virtues so long as it gets them where they want to go. This is very apt, sir.
Yes, I find that's true. I think as very often is the case that people were willing to accept what science has to teach us so long as it goes along with their preconceived worldviews. But once science starts to butt heads against some of their most cherished beliefs, I think they give themselves license to just give it a pass and just to sort of pick and choose what to believe, sort of a la carte, which I think is, as I explain in the book more thoroughly, is kind of a dangerous thing to do.
So the tagline of your book is Finding Truth and Meaning in a Scientific Worldview, which sounds very big indeed. In a nutshell, what are you saying there?
Well, basically, I'm saying that the scientific worldview as a way of understanding the human condition, I think has proven over the last three or four centuries to be the most reliable way we have to determine how the world works and our place in the world, sort of a way of defining what the human condition is. And I maintain that that's very important, not only for our technological progress, but also for our moral progress. Because I also say in the book that in order to have a true sense of right and wrong, you must first know what is true. And I think where human beings have erred previously, and often grievously, is where we take our most cherished beliefs and we don't even consider that we could possibly be wrong about them. And as a result, that has caused us to do some very, very nasty things.
So sometimes it seems like you're writing for the very people you're trying to convert, and other times it seems a bit like you're sort of preaching to the converted. I'm interested, what was your target audience?
Actually, I had two target audiences, and you're right on both counts. I was speaking partly to my scientific colleagues, trying to encourage them to join me and some others who are popularizers of science in trying to get the word out and trying to sort of demystify the scientific process. I know many scientists, although they will all sort of give lip service and say that, yes, it's important to have a scientifically literate citizenry and everyone should understand, you know, science and be critical thinkers. But they don't really do anything, to make that happen. And what I extol in my book in several places, I try to convince my colleagues that actually people are very, very able to understand science if we just speak about science in plain language without all the jargon. And it's important for all scientists to sort of take the time, as hard as that can be sometimes, with, you know, as difficult as it is to keep the scientific projects going with the grant writing and the publications and scientific journals, But I think, you know, part of our responsibility as scientists is to educate the public as to what we're doing and how science works, so that they can understand what it is that we're trying to say, and sort of understand better what science has to teach us about the world and how it works, and also about ourselves. The other audience I was trying to reach was what I like to call like the contemplative churchgoers, who are sort of invested in the religious types of things, and you know, the dogmas that sort of help us get through our daily lives, but at the same time, those are increasingly making less and less sense. And people who really stop and think about it, I think they're troubled by this. And what I'm trying to teach, or at least to convince them, is that first of all, science is not very difficult to understand. I think anyone can understand how science works at a basic level. And also, once you understand science and what it has to teach us, science is not has a lot of very positive things to say about the humans and the human condition, and that we don't have to worry about some of the negative consequences of just adopting a purely scientific worldview like some folks worry about. So I try to take that and sort of deconstruct it and sort of say, here's how science works, and here it has to teach us so far. And you know what? It actually ends up being more more uplifting than you could ever really expect. So if you really just stop and take a look, there's no real need to fear or worry about the scientific worldview or abandoning our dogmatic beliefs. I think we have to do that at this point, simply because we're getting much too powerful as a species. The way we're sort of terraforming the Earth, often unintentionally, we need to adopt a scientific worldview across the board, so that we can start gaining consensus about these big problems that we need to solve. Well, we're never going to derive at any consensus as long as we are sort of camped in our different dogmatic belief systems, which offer us no way to compromise between these dogmatic beliefs. So I think the scientific worldview offers us a way to sort of come together to realize a uniform and a consistent worldview that we all can agree on, at least for the most part, and that will allow us to work together to solve these issues that are becoming more and more intense.
So in the book, you also make sure to point out there's a difference between knowing science and knowing the scientific process. What did you mean by that?
Well, knowing the scientific process, I mean, science actually is a process. I mean, the scientific method is just a way of knowing things. The way we tend to teach science today, I can sort of understand how a lot of people get turned off, because science very often, and you know, it has been described, especially in the United States, the scientific curriculum has sort of been described as a mile wide and an inch deep, which means that we tend to sort of portray science as a bunch of isolated facts to be memorized, and we don't really teach the students how those facts were gained, how we're able to sort of take these clues from nature and build them up into a cohesive worldview that makes sense. But instead of teaching them the process of science, which is really what science is all about, science is a process. It's not an end in itself. It's always, it's a learning process. But if we just started teaching science as a bunch of facts to be memorized, that's not exactly the kind of way to inspire students to be scientists or to actually enjoy science. Because, again, science really can't tell us anything with 100% certainty, because it's always, we can always get closer and closer to the truth as we build up evidence in support of a certain theory. However, theories, no matter how thoroughly we think they have been proven, they're always susceptible to falsification. So there is no such thing as scientific dogma. And I talk about this a couple of times in the book. Scientific dogma is a myth. It doesn't exist, because by definition, science is a process of learning. No matter how well a theory is proven, and I use the example of evolution. I talk a lot about evolution, especially in the first part of the book, as a way, in the context of describing how science works, because Darwin did such a marvelous job of taking the clues and assembling them and proving his hypothesis. But even evolution, which is probably as thoroughly validated a theory as there is in science, even then we have to admit that if something were to come along, some bit of evidence to cast doubt on it, and if over time more and more evidence were to be accumulated, we are in the business of finding out how the world works and how it really works. We're not wed to any particular worldview. Our mission is to find out how the world works, what our place in the world is, sort of, and to bring the human condition into finer focus so that we can take actions in order to better the human condition and treat one another, you know, better and sort of reduce the amount of misery and in the world. So I think, you know, science, I think, gives us a best opportunity to see the world in a truer light and to use that knowledge for the betterment of everyone, and, you know, humans and animals both.
In the book, you talk a little bit about the value of doubt and the value of being able to doubt sort of intelligently and using creative thinking to help guide you with that. And what had never occurred to me before was that the word doubt actually has huge negative connotations in our society today. To be a doubter is sort of considered to be a bad thing.
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, doubt has gotten a very bad rap, because I think doubt, you know, that's one of the best things we can really teach our children, is to doubt and to, you know, even doubt your own beliefs. I think that's, you know, even your most cherished beliefs, you should always, you know, make room for admitting when you're wrong. And I think, you know, allowing yourself to be wrong, I think, is very liberating in a lot of ways. I mean, there's nothing more stultifying than having to be right all the time. Well, scientists sort of make a living from being wrong. We put out hypotheses all the time based on a little bit of data. We put out a hypothesis and we figure out a way to test that hypothesis. And more often than not, we find that if we weren't totally wrong, we're at least partially wrong. And then we have to go back and modify the hypothesis to fit the data that we gathered, and then we try the whole thing over again. And it's a very iterative process. But scientists really are kind of wrong for a living. I mean, we're wrong more than we're right. And if we're not, that means that we're not really studying anything very interesting. So I think, you know, allowing yourself to be wrong is a wonderful thing. And also allowing yourself to doubt. I think that's the only way you can grow. I mean, if you hold beliefs that are set in stone and you don't allow for any kind of examination of those beliefs, you're never going to grow at all. You're just sort of taking that path away from you. And why would anybody want to do that?
This is Skeptically Speaking, and you're listening to guest host Rochelle Saunders talking with Dennis Trumbull, author of The Way of Science, Finding Truth and Meaning in a Scientific Worldview. We'll be back with more right after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about the general public's perception to science and scientists with author Dennis Trumbull, whose new book is called The Way of Science, Finding Truth and Meaning in a Scientific Worldview. In the section you have in your book where you talk about education and sort of when is the best time to start to impart the values of critical thinking and the ideas of critical thinking into kids, one of the things I couldn't help but think of myself was, you know, that game that kids play when they're really little, where every time you say something, they say why, and then you tell them why, and they say why, and they just keep asking why and why until you finally kind of pull out your hair and go, because I said so. As adults and parents, we tend to shut down why.
Yes,
there's a part of me that wonders if that's kind of part of the problem a little bit.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I did play that game a lot with my parents, and it drove them nuts, I'm sure, just as it does all parents. But you know what? I mean, I maintain that all children are you know, natural-born scientists. And, you know, you come in the world basically knowing nothing and taking in information, and you're trying to process it. And so, you know, so in that sense, you know, as soon as you start to be able to verbalize you know, the first few years you're not verbalizing, you're just sort of taking it in and trying to make sense of it as best you can. And then when you start verbalizing, then you're trying to get those verbal cues. So I guess it's not surprising that children are always asking why. But I think that's just part of their natural inquisitiveness. And unfortunately, that's the kind of inquisitiveness that I think the way we teach science now tends to sort of, you know, beat that out of them after a while. I think, you know, as maddening as it can be, I think we really need to encourage children to ask why. Of course, you know, there is a limit to, you know, how far down the rabbit hole you can go with a certain line of questioning. But I would, you know, just sort of advise folks to sort of be as patient as you can, because remember, your kids are just trying to figure things out. They really don't know. And they're just looking for clues. They're forming their own hypotheses, and they're collecting their own data. And so, you know, so they're just bouncing their hypotheses off you and trying to get more information, more data. So I mean, that's a wonderful thing about little children. I mean, again, they're all just a bunch of, you know, natural born scientists. They're really just trying to make sense of the world. And I think if everyone would just sort of hold on to that same kind of questioning, constant questioning, you know, that would allow them to, you know, sort of grow throughout life instead of sort of getting to a certain point in our teenage years or young adulthood where we figure, you know, where we think we have it all figured out, and then we just stop and say, okay, this is the way the world works, and I'm not going to accept any other version now because this is the way I was taught, or this is the conclusion I've come to. It's like, no, you should never do that. You should always be questioning. You should always be reexamining things in order to, you know, sort of at least double check and make sure that the beliefs that you do hold still make sense. And if not, you should be willing to change them, or at least modify them to adjust to the new information that you have. I mean, to me, that's just a part of growing as a human being and as a person.
So I want to talk a little bit about how science and scientists in particular, are perceived by the general public. Your book takes time to consider this as well. You've even coined a phrase, geek mystique. What does that mean?
Yes, the geek mystique, I sort of coined that to describe how scientists get a very, I would say, almost undeserved reputation for being a lot smarter than we really are. I mean, I explain in the book that I believe the chapter is called like Confessing a Murder. And I think this, you know, which is based on something that Darwin once said about his theory as he wrote a letter to Hooker about his theory, and he said it was like confessing a murder. And I thought, you know, like confessing that scientists are not really any smarter than anybody else, it's sort of like confessing a murder, because scientists tend to benefit a lot from this reputation of ours. I mean, you know, a lot of people give a lot of money to scientific organizations, and we get a lot of grant money to solve problems because people figure that we're smart enough to do it, and we're smart enough because we're smarter than them. But, you know, that has a negative side, too. And the negative side is that a lot of people become intimidated by science, and they think, you know, science is something that only scientists can understand because they're so much smarter than we are. You know, a great deal of effort to try to take that myth and sort of demolish it, because in truth, we scientists, we really aren't any smarter than any other group of people you could name. You know, I know there are some scientists who sort of get frustrated with folks on the religious right. And you know, they think, well, geez, these people are not very smart. Look at their beliefs. And I take some time in the book to try to understand why they believe these things. I give them credit for being smart people, intelligent people who believe things for a reason. And I think it's up to scientists and educators to sort of convince them that the reasons that they're holding on to these beliefs are not sound. People in general, of course, not all people, of course, but I think generally speaking, people are quite smart and able to understand anything that, you know, I say in this book, or anything that a lot of scientists say in their books as well, as long as it's not just so jargonized that it's incomprehensible. But I am convinced that, you know, scientists as a group, we're just like everyone else. The only thing is we just sort of maintain our childhood, you know, fascination with trying to figure out the way things work. And we just never stop that process of questioning and asking why. But practically everyone is capable of understanding science and the way science works, and capable of becoming critical thinkers in the most important sense of the word. And I think if we were able to eventually get enough people on board to sort of create what I call a critical mass of critical thinkers, I think we can start coming together around some of these divisive issues like global warming and such things where, you know, we spent way too much time debating this issue, and now we find ourselves in a situation where it may be too late to do much about it. You know, science is a double-edged sword. It's given us all this technology, and it's allowed us to take over the entire world, and it's allowed us to basically terraform the whole world and pump enough CO2 into the atmosphere to change the environment. And also, we have enough power that we're able to reduce the biodiversity across the world. We're able to fish the oceans almost, you know, in a way that, you know, we never thought possible. I mean, the oceans were like inexhaustible source of fish. Well, now we've gotten so good at fishing that even that's not even true anymore. And, you know, we have to start thinking about these things in long terms, and we have to, you know, come together around common consensus. And the only way to do that is to step back and look at things critically from a scientific mindset and say, okay, here's the situation, here's the way the world is now, and what can we do to try to make it better?
Okay, so scientists are regular people and anyone can understand science.
Except, I firmly believe this.
Except Not really, because today's groundbreaking science is incredibly specialized and goes way deeper than the average layperson can usually understand without months or even years of training and effort. Is knowing critical thinking enough? I mean, a lot of the latest science is really difficult to follow. And I say this as someone who reads a lot of it and, you know, works on a radio show that talks about it all the time.
We know, Rochelle, that's true. But, you know, the scientists can't understand the other scientists who are not in their, you know, area of expertise either. I mean, I would have just as much trouble as you, and I do, I'm sure, trying to understand reading papers from areas that are not in my area of expertise. Because you're right, it is so very specialized. So scientists struggle with this as much as anyone does. Anything, you know, outside of our own narrow area of expertise is something that we kind of, you know, we just have to take a look at it and we have to trust the people in that area of specialty, all the scientists, to police themselves, which they do through the peer review process, to make sure that all the information is on the up and up. And I do explain in the book why that is so important and why scientists are motivated to do just that. But in truth, you know, when I pick up the journal Science thing and I flip through the pages and I'm looking at the various articles, all very interesting, but boy, most really beyond my ability to critically, you know, criticize, really. I mean, because I don't know enough about it. So we're kind of all in the same boat as far as that goes. Society is so specialized anyways. There's a lot of things that go on even outside of science that are so specialized that, you know, I don't understand how it all works. And, you know, so I honestly do believe that the general public and scientists as a group, you know, we're not that much smarter. You know, we're really not any smarter than anybody else, honestly. I mean, you know, and as a scientist, you know, I may be a little hesitant to say that, but I think it's come to the point where we really have to make that clear, and we really have to sort of debunk the geek mystique and let people know that, you know, you should not be intimidated by science. Science is a very simple process. Sure, the details can get kind of hairy, and it can be very specialized. But if you really want to, delve into a subject, if it really interests you enough, I believe, you know, just about anyone can become conversant in any specific specialty if they would, you know, choose to do so.
In most cases, the average kind of person on the street who can't understand the deep science, or who, I guess, can't isn't the word we're looking for here because it doesn't have to do with intelligence, but doesn't have the time to devote to understanding the science and has to kind of trust the scientific process and trust the scientists. Doesn't this kind of boil down to people just have to have faith in science?
Well, no, actually it doesn't. And I'm glad you brought that up because it is something that, you know, I can understand how people might think that, because it's like you're looking at this, you know, claim made by the scientists and you have no way of checking it yourself. and you don't have the time. I mean, people are very busy. They have their own lives. They have their jobs. They're raising children. They're just trying to get by. They don't have time to go and sort of delve into these things themselves. So they do kind of have to trust the scientific process. So that's why I do spend a lot of time sort of explaining how that process works, especially the peer review process, and why scientists are so invested and so enthusiastic about knocking down each other's hypotheses, even when there's, you know, any little sign of a crack. I assure you, you know, anyone who's ever gone to a scientific meeting or presented a paper in front of an audience will understand just how enthusiastic some of these scientists are in sort of knocking down or poking holes in your particular hypothesis. They are very, very enthusiastic about self-policing. And again, you know, it's in our self-interest, because as scientists, we really rely on the authenticity or the veracity of the data, because the data are something that we build on, you know. So in order for our research to go forward, we have to build on something that's real. So if we're, you know, basing a hypothesis on false information, then our hypothesis is going to fall down eventually. So it's really in every scientist's best interest to make sure that the data are as true and as you know, verifiable as we can make it. But again, always with the knowledge that, you know, no theory is beyond reproach, and, you know, everything is subject to revision and you know, looking at it again as new evidence comes to light.
I know a lot of this confusion and frustration from a layperson comes from some extent from the media, because we read, you know, this week we read coffee will take years off your life, and next week we read coffee extends your life by 10 years, and then the week after coffee kills you again. And it's very confusing to try and make sense of this, because obviously we're not reading papers, but we get what we get mostly through the media. So how do we navigate that?
Yes, that's a very good point. And the reason this happens is it's not that the science is necessarily bad, or you know, but the fact of the matter is that the world is a very, very complicated place. And, you know, it's hard enough to try to, like, figure out how the world works, like, say, from a physics standpoint, a purely physical standpoint of physics or chemistry. But when you start getting into things like biology and the human body, and, you know, it's very easy to get experiments or take data that, you know, shows you one little sliver of what's going on, and that could lead you to one conclusion, and then another group takes another bit of data that gives you another bit of sliver that sort of suggests that just the opposite. But the thing is, over time, as we gather more and more information, a lot of these things that look to be sort of the opposite of each other, sort of coming to opposite conclusions, are really just sort of different sides of the same coin, and it just sort of reflects the complexity of the world we live in. So I guess the take-home message is when you hear of a particular study, just one study, you should really take it with a grain of salt and understand that a single study is just that. It's one study. It's a snapshot of the way things are in this one particular situation. Maybe they tested something in a particular animal model, and maybe that animal model doesn't really truly reflect the human condition as much as the researchers think it does. But, you know, the take home is that, you know, these individual conclusions that come from individual studies, you know, they might be right, they might be wrong, but chances are that they, you know, they're just, you know, again, they're not trying to say that this is absolutely true. They're saying, based on this experiment and based on these data, this is a conclusion that we have tentatively put out. But understanding that it is, you know, we can revise it as more data comes in. So we'll take a look at the experiments that, you know, sort of imply the opposite, and we'll keep compiling the information and compiling it, and eventually we'll come up with a better picture of, you know, how coffee really does affect the human body, and, you know, in what doses and in what, you know, there's so many variables. That's the thing. There are so many different things that affect the way, say, you know, something like how coffee affects the human body. As you know, when do you drink it? How much do you drink? You know, what type? Just dozens and dozens of variables, and it depends on how you set up your experiment. So, you know, and people really need to understand this. This is all part of being scientifically literate. So you know, anyone who is scientifically literate will know not to take a single study as being the end, you know, and that if two studies seem to conflict, it's not an indication that science is not working. It's actually an indication that science is working. And it's just, you know, it's sort of like looking at science in the process of trying to come up with a cohesive, true understanding of what's really going on. And the fact of the matter is, when we're talking about the human body, it's so incredibly complex, it's going to take us a very long time to unravel a lot of what's going on inside the body as we, you know, put caffeine into it or different drugs or all kinds of different things.
So I'm interested to get your perspective on this. A lot of modern science journalism isn't done in mainstream media anymore. There's a continuing movement to get science journalism. It's not a push. It just sort of is happening, I think, a bit organically, pushing towards blogs and specific websites. It's really moving online to kind of different spaces than necessarily the big newspapers, the big broadcast media. Scientists are blogging about their work and their related work, partially as outreach, partially to discuss it with the rest of the scientific community. And a lot of it is really interesting as a you know, science curious layperson to read, because a lot of it is pretty accessible. Is there a difference? Do you see a difference between the way traditional science journalism works in mainstream media and the way sort of the online science journalist, science blogger has taken to talking about this stuff? Is one better than the other?
Well, I think they are certainly very different, and I think they are both positive in different ways. I think, you know, I certainly applaud all the science bloggers and the scientists who have blogs and are sort of reaching out. And again, this is what I say is so important. Scientists need to do more of this. We need to start reaching out to the public and speaking in clear terms about what we do and how we do it, and maybe, you know, setting up a blog and maybe answering questions. I think that is a wonderful way to get the public involved, and just sort of making the science a little bit more accessible and more human, you know, putting it more in human terms, and sort of putting a human face on it. And I think that's all very, very good. And also, of course, the traditional ways of getting your science out is to publish in peer-reviewed journals, and certainly even peer-reviewed online journals. But I think the peer review process is something we really cannot shortcut. I mean, any scientist is free to set up a blog and talk about his work and sort of put out his hypotheses, and I think, you know, and he can say, well, this is what I think. But there's no one there, you know, apart from any other scientist who might be reading the blog to say, well, maybe yes, maybe no. But if you're submitting your work in a very formal form to a journal, whether it be online journal or a traditional paper journal, and it gets sent out to reviewers, the people of your own specialty, to can critique what you're doing and sort of point out some of the shortfalls or some of the things that you maybe could do better, or some of the things you hadn't thought about. That is also very, very important. I think it's really indispensable. And so I don't think we can ever get away from the peer-reviewed journals and, you know, both paper and online. But I really do applaud those scientists who are trying to get their work out in a more accessible form to the public and are, you know, interacting with the folks who, you know, read their blogs, ask the questions, and, you know, get that immediate feedback. I think that's a very good thing.
I was actually sort of wondering more about sort of the science blogger versus the kind of journalist at the New York Times who writes a piece that gets sort of run through this massive editorial machine before it gets posted versus, you know, the science blogger who reads a bunch of stuff, writes it, and just posts it. I was curious as to your take on, is one of those better? Is one of those, do you find value in one or both maybe?
I think there's value in both, but the thing is, you know, the thing with the internet is that there's so much information out there, some of it good, some of it not so good, some of it totally patently false. And so, you know, and with the internet, you can always go and find websites that are going to confirm your beliefs no matter what they are. And so, you know, so people who just like do science blogs and are not very rigorous about, I mean, if they're just sort of like scientific links, so they're sort of voyeurs, or they just want to sort of start a sort of a chat about, you know, science. I mean, I think that's fine, but I think people need to be scientifically literate enough to understand what the value of the information is. And if it's not been vetted through the peer review process, you sort of take it again with a very large grain of salt. I mean, it's not to say that what the person is saying is not true or is not valid, but you have to understand, you know, whether it's been through the peer review process and whether it has been, you know, checked by the experts in the field. Because again, you know, there's not too many of us who can. In fact, there's nobody in the world who can understand everything across the scientific board. We're all far too specialized. But as far as science journalism goes, I mean, I think there's great value certainly in the traditional journalism. You know, science journalists who do their job through the editorial process, and you know, there's a specific process that they need to go through in order to get that information out to the other side, and there's a certain vetting that goes through that it has to go through. I think that is valuable. Whereas, you know, the other way, where you can just get it on without having anyone sort of, you know, eyeball it and sort of double check it. Again, as long as your audience understands that that's what you're doing, they can sort of take it for what it's worth, and they can, you know, decide for themselves, take a look at it, maybe check it against some other sources. You know, that's being scientifically literate. That's understanding how information is processed and vetted. Because anyone really, I mean, anyone can have a blog. Anyone can say anything. That's, you know, that's the double-edged sword that we have, you know, as far as the World Wide Web.
Dennis, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Rochelle. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
If you want to learn more about Dennis Trumbull and his new book, The Way of Science, Finding Truth and Meaning in a Scientific Worldview, you can visit our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, where a link to his book will be available in our show notes.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're jamming to the rhythm of the insect world. We'll speak to musician and philosopher David Rothenberg, author of the book Bug Music, How Insects Gave Us Rhythm and Noise, about the possible insect inspirations for human music. And we're joined by entomologist Gwen Pearson, also known as Bug Girl, to talk about the interesting ways that insects make sounds with their bodies. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm Desiree Schell. A new survey by Ipsos Mori for the Royal Statistical Society and King's College London highlighted just how wrong the British public can be on the makeup of the population and the scale of key social policy issues. We're joined by Bobby Duffy, Managing Director of Ipsos Mori Social Research Institute and Visiting Senior Research Fellow at King's College London. Welcome, sir.
Great to be here.
Okay, so tell us about this survey.
Yeah, it's a study that we did specifically looking for what type of areas people are most wrong on in terms of their perceptions versus the reality across the makeup of the population and key social policy issues. So it's been something that we've investigated on various policy issues over the years, but we thought we'd do a study that brings it all together. It's part of the International Year of Statistics with the Royal Statistical Society in King's College London here. So we tried to cover off as many of some of the big issues, big policy issues that we have in the UK, and some of the scale of misperceptions there are, it's just scary.
Well, how was the study undertaken? Who was completing the survey, first of all?
Who was competing? So this is of the British public. A representative sample of people aged 18 to 75 among the British public conducted online with a representative quota set so that it's we're getting a good cross-section of the public.
Well, give us some examples of the questions, because those are very interesting.
Some of the ones that stand out in terms of misperceptions are people's perception of benefit fraud. So it's a big issue in the media here, the extent to which people who are claiming welfare benefits are doing so fraudulently. And we ask people, out of every £100, how many pounds you think are claimed fraudulently. And the average estimate, the mean estimate across the whole of the whole sample that responded was that £24 out of every £100 was claimed fraudulently, when actually the official estimate, which the government spends a lot of time collecting, is that it's only 70 pence. So people are 34 times estimating the extent of benefit fraud by a scale of 34 times.
How about teenage pregnancy?
Yeah, that's another one that really stands out as people getting wrong. So on average, we think that teenage pregnancy rate is 25 times higher than it actually is, according to official estimates. So we think in the UK that 15% of girls under the age of 16, and the under the age of 16 was emphasized to people, get pregnant every year, and official figures put it around 0.6%. So that's a significant proportion of every single 15-year-old class of schoolgirls getting pregnant every year.
And something else that's been in the news in your country is immigration and ethnicity.
Yeah, so immigration, we again, this is something we've asked in the past, and it's very consistent over time. So when we ask people to estimate the proportion of the population that are immigrants, we consistently find around 30% is the estimate. So people think that nearly one in every three people in the country is an immigrant, when actually, again, official figures put it around 13%. And even the people who talk about illegal immigration, when they try to add on the estimates of illegal immigration, that adds barely 1% to that. So even taking that into account, there's a massive gap between perception and reality on that. And the same with the Muslim population in particular. We estimate, as a country, we guess that 24% of the population are Muslim, when it's actually 5% in England and Wales overall. So again, five times above the actual. But just the thought of people thinking that one in four people within our country are Muslims just shows how skewed perceptions are.
Well, this isn't just an opportunity to feel smug about how wrong people are.
Yeah.
These overestimations have some very real impacts on policy.
Yeah, they can do. I mean, that's why we're so interested in them, is if people have such wildly wrong perceptions of the extent of social issues or the extent of a population, then that will affect how much they call for policies to deal with that, and that will affect how politicians react and what they put into policy. So it is an important thing when you have these massive misperceptions. It has to be said, there's something else going on here too, which again has been studied in academic circles, is you do get something called emotional innumeracy, which is people are partly wrong because they're trying to be accurate, but they just don't know the answer. But they're also partly wrong maybe because they're trying to make a point. So whether they know it consciously or not, the fact that something worries them may affect how big a proportion of the population they think something is. So if they're worried about the proportion of Muslims in the population, then that kind of encourages people to overestimate it. So there's a complex interaction between what people estimate in these types of things and their concerns. One leads to the other, but there's a bit of it vice versa.
And the unfortunate thing is this can also be manipulated by policymakers to support action on their own pet issues.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was a terrible vicious circle here of interaction between public media and politicians, where these types of stories and misperceptions are reinforced. I think we did some other work with Royal Statistical Society and King's College London, which looked at more people's understanding of statistics. And it's very clear from that, we did some experimental tests trying to see what people focus on in the information that they give you, but drawing on some social psychology theories. And it's very clear that the information that people remember is negative information. And we've seen that in experimental things in social psychology for a number of years. So it's quite easy to stoke up fear when you have those communications getting to people through the media, because people remember negative information and they focus much more on anecdote than hard facts.
So then why are people so very wrong about these topics? As you said, is it just the emotional connotation?
Well, I think there's probably four main explanations. That would be one of them, is that it's partly a reflection of their concerns. I think there's just simple measurement and definitional problems with some of this. When we ask people, they may not always be thinking about the same thing we are. So when we ask people about benefit fraud, some of the things that they count as benefit fraud in that £24 out of the £100 are not things that the government would count as fraud. So that includes people not having contributed tax in the past just because they've never had a job, say, or people having more children so that they can claim more benefits. That's not fraudulent, but from people's perceptions, they think that's playing the system, and so they would be counting that as fraud in their minds. So we have those types of things. Then we do have those type of statistical literacy problems where people just don't understand or really struggle with very big and very small numbers. It's quite notable that where people are mostly wrong, it's to do with something that's either very big, like the extent of government spending on foreign aid, which people are very wrong about. They think it's much higher than it is, but that's because we are talking in billions of pounds or dollars, so it seems like a huge amount of money to them, so they struggle then to translate that into actually maybe a huge amount of money, but it's a very small proportion of the overall government spending. So that difficulty people have just with the pure numbers and the difference between rates and amounts is another group of explanations for it.
Well, I'm going to assume that this level of wrongness probably exists in other countries as well.
Yeah, we did a bit of international comparisons on it, not through this survey, but looking at previous ones. And interestingly, it's almost identical in the US on overestimation of immigration. We get very, very similar figures. And similarly, there's a lot more work in the US on estimation of different ethnic minority groups. And again, very similar patterns to what we see in the UK. And immigration is a study that's brought together dozens of similar studies across Europe and other countries in the world, and no one underestimates the proportion of immigration. Every country overestimates it, some by a lot more than others, and the UK and the US are kind of grouped together with a few other countries as being most likely to overestimate, but every single country is in the same direction.
So thoughts about what to do about this then, either from an individual perspective or broader?
Yeah, I think what you need to decide what the cause is before you decide what you're going to do. And I think, unfortunately, it's probably a mix of all these things, of people reflecting their concerns back, of people having trouble with numbers, of the media impact, of the kind of social psychology, behavioral science aspects of things where people don't think through these things logically. So you need to have a range of responses because it's a range of causes. I think as a starting point, having some focus on statistical literacy among children, greater focus on that in our education systems is important. And that's not so much about the theory of maths and all of those statistical aspects, but it's trying to get kids excited about applying that type of thinking to real-world problems. Too much of our math teaching in the UK, at least, is theoretical. Getting some of that statistical thinking applied at an early age is very important. But then alongside that, you really do need, a greater focus on the misuse of data by politicians and the media. We've got various activities here around people auditing the use of statistics and pulling people up when they're misusing them. That doesn't mean just lying about them. It means not giving an idea that this may be happening, but it's very rare, so you shouldn't really be worrying about it. And so there's some good examples of that, but that just needs to be beefed up. We need to see more of that. We can nowadays with the technology that we have through internet and other social media approaches to actually push that out to people a bit more. But even so, that's always going to be difficult. It's not going to reach everyone. But maybe technology does give us a better ability now to have more deliberative type discussions with people, where you're actually providing them with more information through online forums and getting their reaction to that, rather than just taking their responses from knee-jerk reactions to what they see in the media.
Well, so what advice would you have for just somebody reading the paper and coming up against these stats? Are there any red flags, or how should people be thinking about this?
Yeah, it's so difficult because it is in a Daniel Kahneman type way. We have system one and system two thinking. It's very hard to turn off your system one because you react to the anecdote on these types of things. And I guess that's for all of us to just step back from the anecdote, which grabs our attention, and think, actually, How realistic and how prevalent is this going to be? Not just does it exist, but actually is it a serious issue that's at scale within society rather than a one-off? That's the key thing is, yes, this may be true, but is it widespread and important?
Bobby Duffy, thanks very much for being here.
No problem at all.
We'll include a link to the research on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Now let's head back across the Atlantic for a conversation with Katie Gibbs. Katie recently finished her PhD in biology at the University of Ottawa, and she was one of the lead organizers of the Death of Evidence rally. She's currently the executive director of Evidence for Democracy, a new organization that advocates for the transparent use of evidence in government decision-making and public policy development. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go back to the summer of 2012. What was going on in Canada at that time?
Well, the Harper government had recently announced their first omnibus budget bill. And in that bill, there had been a whole slew of funding changes for science, as well as changes to legislation that really, in our mind, reduced the amount of science and evidence that was needed in that legislation for decision making. As well, they had recently announced that they were removing funding for the Experimental Lakes area.
Right.
So all of those things, I think, you know, really created a point where the science community that I was involved with, you know, kind of felt like we needed to do something. And, you know, this had fallen on the heels of other things like getting rid of the mandatory long-form census that we were really upset about. But then this one, you know, all of the changes in the omnibus budget bill really brought it to a head.
And if anyone out there needs more examples of awful, check out my interview with John Dupuy on episode 221. That's 221. That's the War on Science episode, and it is fairly horrifying. So
yeah, there's a very long list.
Very, very long list. So, of course, your response was the Death of Evidence rally. So what was that?
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you know, it's actually really interesting. Most of the scientists that I knew at the University of Ottawa were very much, you know, afraid of any kind of advocacy. You know, they really did kind of feel that scientists, you know, should just kind of stick to the labs and do their work. And it was interesting to see the shift in their mind when all of these things were happening. They really seemed to come to the conclusion that if, you know, if scientists don't speak up about what's going on, nobody else is going to. You know, we're the ones who really understand the impacts of these changes. And so, you know, it's really part of our duty as scientists to speak out about what these changes could mean. So, you know, it started over beers on a Friday, you know,
as the best things do.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, we had this idea to do this sort of funeral march to sort of mourn the death of evidence in Canada, you know, complete with the coffin that we filled with books and a Grim Reaper and, you know, just a horde of scientists in their lab coats behind them. So, you know, we marched a few blocks through downtown Ottawa, and, you know, the turnout was incredible. We had expected maybe 500 people, and, you know, the estimates were between 2,000 and 4,000 people. So, you know, the turnout was really great. And, you know, the media, we got tons of media covered. So, you know, I think it was really effective in, you know, in my mind, what it did is a lot of these things had been reported on before, but they were reported on very, in a very isolated way. Whereas I think what the rally did is it really sort of combined all these individual things that had happened into this larger sort of narrative, that there was, you know, a systematic dismantling of science in Canada taking place.
So now that's fantastic, but unfortunately things haven't gotten any better and might have in fact gotten worse. So tell us about your new organization, Evidence for Democracy.
Yeah, well, you know, there was so much energy coming out of the rally that, you know, we had people coming up to us asking, you know, well, what's next? And we were like, well, that's a great question. We hadn't really thought of it. So, you know, we spent a lot of time talking to, you know, other people involved, other organizations, to try to really figure out, you know, what we could do that would help. And, you know, there are some science organizations in Canada, but what really was missing is anybody really advocating for, you know, evidence and science in public policy and in government decision making. And so, you know, we thought it would be great to start an organization that really focused on that. So, you know, what we're really trying to do is get the public, you know, excited and involved and get them to, you know, really understand why science matters in public policy, why it matters for their daily lives. Because I'm not sure that most Canadians, you know, have a great appreciation of that. Mm-hmm. And in turn, you know, we want them to ask questions. When, you know, a minister announces a new policy, we want them to ask, you know, well, what's the evidence for that? What is the evidence that that is going to do what you say it's going to do? You know, and so that's, you know, that's really our goal, is to just kind of raise that bar in Canada and get Canadians asking, you know, what's the evidence?
I love you guys already. That's all I'm saying.
Excellent.
Well, let's get specific. Let's talk about your current campaign, Science Uncensored.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure people who listen have likely heard of the muzzling of government scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to do a campaign specifically focused on that. I think that, you know, this is really concerning. You know, it's not just this issue in my mind goes way beyond science. It's really an affront to our democracy in my mind. You know, we think part of evidence-based decision-making really means having a public that knows all the facts and is informed and engaged, and that enables them to be able to make better decisions. And, you know, what we've seen is systematic changes to the communication policies in government that really prohibit scientists from talking to the media. And, you know, it's really been a very significant shift in the relationship that we've seen between government science and the media. So we launched this campaign to try to bring attention to that, as well as, you know, we have a petition there for people to sign, you know, saying that they do want better, more open communication policies.
And how many people have signed that? Do you know at this point?
So far, it's about 6,300.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not just the petition you want people to sign. Your website said that there's three things people can do to help.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the first one is you just go to the website and send this message to the government, letting them know that you do want open communication policies. The next step is to get the word out. You know, there are still a lot of people who aren't aware of what's going on. So, you know, you can forward the site to them, share it on Facebook, tweet about it, and that just helps, you know, make people aware of what's going on. And then the third one is, you know, we're a brand new organization and we're just getting started, and so we could really use donations from our supporters to really help us advocate for evidence in government decision making and to help us continue to fight the muzzling of government scientists.
And people can do all that by heading to scienceuncensored.ca. Now, what's next then? What's Evidence for Democracy going to take on?
Yeah, so right now the big thing that we're working on is rallies for the fall. So we're organizing Stand Up for Science rallies that are going to take place on September 16th. So far we're looking at rallies in Ottawa, Toronto, Vancouver, Victoria, Montreal, possibly one in Alberta, possibly one in Nova Scotia. So we're really excited to, you know, take what happened with the Death of Evidence rally and now take it sort of across the country and get, you know, numerous rallies going on the same day for people to stand up for science and really show their support for science and really trying to restore science in Canada.
And there will be a full list closer to the date, I assume, on the website?
Absolutely. So shortly we'll also be launching our Evidence for Democracy website at evidencefordemocracy.ca, and there'll be all the information for the rallies will be up there.
Katie, great to have you here. Absolutely. And
yeah,
I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you in the future.
I'd be glad to come back on in the future.
You can find a link to Katie Gibbs at Evidence for Democracy on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll also post a link to the Science Uncensored campaign so that you can send your own letter, like I did. And while you're there, you can click all the various social media links or the link to iTunes so that you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.